Your reward, of course, Dalinar said, would be legitimacy as a High Lord in the kingdom, perhaps that High Prince's place. And no fighting today, Tanelon said. No deaths. No deaths. Except perhaps for the actual traitors. Tanelon looked to his advisors. The man with the birthmark nodded slowly. They headed east, toward the unclaimed hills, Tanelon said, pointing. 100 soldiers and caravaniers. I think they were planning to stay for the night in the waystop at a town called Videliar.
Who was it? Dalinar asked. Which High Prince?
It might be best if you find out for yourself as...
Who? Dalinar demanded.
Bright Lord Toral Sadius.
Sadius? Impossible.
As I said, Tanelon noted, best if you see for yourself. But I will testify before the king, assuming you keep your side of our accord.
Open your gates to my men, Dalinar said, pointing. Stand down your soldiers. You have my word of honor for your safety.
With that, he turned and trotted back toward his forces, passing into a corridor of men. As he did, Teleb ran up to meet him.
Bright Lord, he said. My scouts have returned from surveying that caravan. Sir, it
was from a High Prince.
Undoubtedly, Teleb said. They couldn't determine which one, but they claim to have seen someone in shard plate among them.
Shard plate? That made no sense. Unless that is how he's planning to see that we lose, Dalinar thought. That might not have been a simple supply caravan. It could be a flanking force in disguise. A single shard-bearer hitting the back of his army while it was distracted could do incredible damage. Dalinar didn't believe Tanelon, not completely. But, storms, if Sadius secretly had sent one of his shard-bearers to the battlefield, Dalinar couldn't just send a simple team of soldiers to deal with him.
You have command, he said to Teleb. Tanelon is going to stand down. Have the vanguard join the locals on the fortifications, but do not displace them. Camp the rest of the army back in the field, and keep our officers out of Rathalas. This isn't a surrender. We're going to pretend that he was on our side all along, so he can save face and preserve his title. Orinar, I want a company of 100 elites, our fastest, ready to march with me immediately.
They obeyed, asking no questions. Runners dashed with messages, and the entire area became a hive of motion, men and women hastening in all directions. One person stood still in the midst of it, hands clasped hopefully at her breast.
"What happened?"
Evie asked as he trotted his horse toward her.
"Go back to our camp and compose a message to my brother saying that we may have brought the rift to our side without bloodshed."
He paused, then added,
"Tell him not to trust anyone. One of our closest allies may have betrayed us. I'm going to find out."
72. Rockfall. The Edge Dancers are too busy relocating the tower's servants and farmers to send a representative to record their thoughts in these gemstones. I'll do it for them, then. They are the ones who will be most displaced by this decision. The Radiants will be taken in by nations. But what of all these people, now without homes? From Drawer 417, Second Topaz. The city had a heartbeat, and Vale felt she could hear it when she closed her eyes. She crouched in a dim room, hands touching the smooth stone floor which had been eroded by thousands upon thousands of footfalls. If stone met a man, stone might win. But if stone met humanity, then no force could preserve it. The city's heartbeat was deep within these stones, old and slow. It had yet to realize something dark had moved in. A spren, as ancient as it was. An urban disease. People didn't speak of it. They avoided the palace, mentioned the queen only to complain about the Ardent who had been killed. It was like standing in a high storm and griping that your shoes were too tight. A soft whistling drew Vale's attention. She looked up and scanned the small loading dock around her, occupied only by herself, Vatha, and their wagon. "Let's go." Vale eased the door open and entered the mansion proper. She and Vatha wore new faces. Hers was a version of Vale with too large a nose and dimpled cheeks. His was the face of a brutish man Shallan had seen in the market. Red's whistle meant the coast was clear, so they strode down the hallway without hesitation. This extravagant stone mansion had been built around a square, skylit atrium where manicured shale bark and rock buds flourished, bobbing with life spren. The atrium went up 4 stories, with walkways around each level. Red was on the second, whistling as he leaned on the balustrade. The real showpiece of the mansion, however, wasn't the garden, but waterfalls, because not a single one of them was actually water. They had been, once. But sometime long ago, someone had mixed far too much wealth with far too much imagination. They had hired soulcasters to transform large fountains of water that had been poured from the top level, 4 stories up. They'd been soulcast into other materials right as the water splashed to the floor. Vale's path took her along rooms to her left, with an overhang of the first floor's atrium balcony overhead. A former waterfall spilled down to her right, now made of crystal. The shape of flowing water crashed forever onto the stone floor, where it blossomed outward in a wave, brilliant and glistening. The mansion had changed hands dozens of times, and people called it Rockfall, despite the newest owner's attempt over the last decade to rename it the incredibly boring Haddonal Keep. Vale and Vatha hurried along, accompanied by Red's reassuring whistling. The next waterfall was similar in shape, but made instead from polished, dark stumpweight wood. It looked strangely natural, almost like a tree could have grown in that shape, poured from above and running down in an undulating column, splashing outward at the base. They soon passed a room to their left, where Ishna was talking with the current mistress of Rockfall. Each time the Everstorm struck, it left destruction, but in an oddly distinct way from a high storm. Everstorm lightning had proven its greatest danger. The strange red lightning didn't merely set fires or scorch the ground. It could break through rock, causing blasts of fragmenting stone. One such strike had broken a gaping hole in the side of this ancient celebrated mansion. It had been patched with an unsightly wooden wall that would be covered with creme, then finally bricked over. Brightness Nananov, a middle-aged Alethi woman with a bun of hair practically as tall as she was, gestured at the boarded-up hole and then at the floor. "You'll make them match the others," Nananov said to Ishna, who wore the guise of a rug merchant. "I won't stand for them to be even a shade off. When you return with the repaired rugs, I'm going to set them beside the ones in other rooms to check."
"Yes, Brightness," Ishna said. "But the damage is much worse than I—"
"These rugs were woven in Shinovar. They were made by a blind man who trained 30 years with a master weaver before being allowed to produce his own rugs. He died after finishing my commission, so there are no others like these."
"I'm well aware, as you've told me 3 times now."
Vale took a memory of the woman. Then she and Vatha slipped past the room, continuing along the atrium. They were supposedly part of Ishna's staff, and wouldn't be suffered to wander about freely. Red, noting that they were on their way, started to head back to rejoin Ishna. He'd have been excused to visit the privy, but would be missed if he was gone too long. His tune cut off. Vale opened a door and pulled Vatha inside, heart thrumming as, right outside, a pair of guards walked down the stairwell from the second level.
"I still say we should be doing this at night," Vatha whispered. "They have this place guarded like a fort at night."
The change of the guard was in mid-morning, so Vale and the others had come just before that. Theoretically, this meant the guards would be tired and bored after an uneventful night. Vale and Vatha had entered a small library lit by a few spheres in a goblet on the table. Vatha eyed them, but didn't move. This infiltration was about far more than a few chips. Vale set down her pack and rummaged until she got out a notebook and charcoal pencil. Vale took a deep breath, then let Shallan bleed back into existence. She quickly sketched Nananov from the glimpse earlier.
"I'm still amazed you were both of them all along," Vatha said. "You don't act anything like one another."
"That's rather the point, Vatha."
"I wish I'd picked it out myself," he grunted, scratching the side of his head. "I like Vale."
"Not me?"
"You're my boss. I'm not supposed to like you."
"Straightforward, if rude. At least you always knew where you stood with him." He listened at the door, then cracked it open, tracking the guards.
"All right. We go up the stairs, then come back along the second floor walkway. We grab the goods, stuff them in the dumbwaiter, and make for the exit." "Storms. I wish we could do this when nobody was awake."
"What would be the fun of that?" Shallan finished her drawing with a flourish, then stood, poking Vatha in the side. "Admit it, you're enjoying this."
"I'm as nervous as a new recruit on his first day at war," Vatha said. "My hands shake, and I swear every noise means someone spotted us. I feel sick."
"See?" Shallan said. "Fun." She pushed beside him and glanced out through the cracked door. Storming guards. They'd set up in the atrium nearby. They could undoubtedly hear the real Nananov's voice from there, so if Shallan strolled out wearing the woman's face, that would certainly cause alarm. Time to get creative. Pattern buzzed as she considered. Make the waterfalls flow again? Illusions of strange spren? No. No, nothing so theatrical. Shallan was letting her sense of the dramatic run away with her. Stay simple, as she'd done before. Vale's way. She closed her eyes and breathed out, pressing the light into pattern, light weaving only sound, that of Nananov calling the guards into the room where she was lecturing Ishna. Why come up with a new trick when the old ones worked fine? Vale didn't feel the need to improvise, merely to be different. Pattern carried the illusion away, and the sound lured the guards off down the hall. Shallan led Vatha out of the library, then around the corner and up the steps. She breathed out stormlight, which washed over her and became Vale fully. Then Vale became the woman who was not quite Vale, with the dimples. And then layered on top of that, she became Nananov. Arrogant, talkative, certain that everyone around her was just looking for a reason not to do things properly. As they stepped onto the next floor, she adopted a calm, measured gait, eyeing the banister. When had that last been polished?
"I don't find this fun," Vatha said, walking beside her. "But I do like it."
"Then it's fun."
"Fun is winning at cards. This is something else."
He'd taken to his role earnestly, but she really should look at getting more refined servants. Vatha was like a hog in human clothing, always grunting and mulling about. Why shouldn't she be served by the best? She was a knight radiant. She shouldn't have to put up with barely human deserters who looked like something Shallan would draw after a hard night drinking, and maybe while holding the pencil with her teeth.
"The role is getting to you," a part of her whispered. "Careful."
She glanced about for Pattern, but he was still below. They stopped at a second-floor room, locked tightly. The plan was for Pattern to open it, but she didn't have the patience to wait. Besides, a master servant was walking along. He gave a bow when he saw Nananov.
"That is your bow?" Nananov said. "That quick, Bob? Where did they teach you that?"
"My apologies, Brightness," the man said, bowing more deeply.
"I could cut your legs off at the knees," Nananov said. "Then maybe you'd at least appear properly penitent," she rapped on the door. "Open this."
What? He broke off, perhaps realizing she was not in a mood for complaints. He hurried forward and undid the combination lock on the door, then pulled it open for her, letting out air that smelled of spice.
You may go do penance for your insult to me, Ninanov said. Climb to the roof and sit there for exactly 1 hour.
Brightness, if I have offended...
If? She pointed. Go!
He gave another bow, barely sufficient, and ran off.
You might be overdoing that, Brightness, Vatha said, rubbing his chin. She has a reputation for being difficult, not insane.
Shut up, Ninanov said, striding into the room.
The mansion's larder.
Racks of dried sausages covered one wall. Sacks of grain were stacked in the back, and boxes filled with long roots and other tubers covered the floor. Bags of spices, small jugs of oil. Vatha pulled the door closed, then hurriedly began stuffing sausages in a sack. Ninanov wasn't so hasty. This was a good place to keep it all, nice and locked up. Taking it elsewhere seemed, well, a crime. Maybe she could move into Rockfall, act the part. And the former lady of the house? Well, she was an inferior version, obviously. Just deal with her. Take her place. It would feel right, wouldn't it? With a chill, Vale let one layer of illusion drop.
Storms. Storms? What had that been? Not to give offense, Brightness, Vatha said, putting his sack of sausages in the dumbwaiter. But you can stand there and supervise, or you can storming help and get twice as much food along with half as much ego.
Sorry, Vale said, grabbing a sack of grain. That woman's head is a frightening place.
Well, I did say that Ninanov is notoriously difficult.
Yeah, Vale thought, but I was talking about Shallan. They worked quickly, filling the large dumbwaiter, which was needed to take in large shipments from the delivery room below. They got all of the sausages, most of the long roots, and a few sacks of grain. Once the dumbwaiter was full, the two of them lowered the thing to the ground floor. They waited by the door, and fortunately Red started whistling. The ground floor was clear again. Not trusting herself with Nananov's face, she stayed Vale as the two hurried out. Pattern waited outside, and he hummed, climbing her trousers. On their way down, they passed a waterfall made of pure marble. Shallan would have loved to linger and marvel at the artful soul-casting. Fortunately, Vale was running this operation. Shallan got lost in things. She'd get focused on details, or stick her head in the clouds and dream about the big picture. That comfortable middle, that safe place of moderation, was unfamiliar ground to her. They descended the steps, then joined Red at the damaged room and helped him carry a rolled-up carpet to the loading bay. She had Pattern quietly open the lock to the dumbwaiter down here, then sent him away to decoy a few servants who had been bringing wood into the bay. They pursued an image of a feral mink with a key in its mouth. Together, Vale, Red, and Vatha unrolled the rug, filled it with sacks of food from the dumbwaiter, then rolled it back up and heaved it into their waiting wagon. The guards at the gate shouldn't notice a few extra bulgy carpets. They fetched a second carpet, repeated the process, then started back. Vale, however, paused in the loading bay right by the door. What was that on the ceiling? She cocked her head at the strange sight of pools of liquid dripping down.
Anger spren, she realized,
collecting there and then boiling through the floor. The larder was directly above them.
Run, Vale said, spinning and bolting back toward the wagon.
A second later, someone upstairs started shouting. Vale scrambled into the wagon's seat, then slapped the chull with the steering reed. Her team, joined by Ishna, charged back into the room and leapt into the wagon, which started moving.
Step by protracted step.
Vale, Shallan slapped the large crab on the shell, urging it forward, But Chulz went at Chulz speed. The wagon eased out into the courtyard, and ahead the gates were already closing.
Storms,
Vatha said. He looked over his shoulder.
Is this part of the fun?
Behind them, Nananav burst out of the building, her hair wobbling.
Stop them! Thieves!
Shallan,
Vatha asked.
Vale, whoever you are. Storms, they have crossbows.
Shallan breathed out. The gates clanged shut ahead of them. Armed guards entered the small courtyard, weapons ready.
Shallan!
Vatha cried. She stood on the wagon, stormlight swirling around her. The Chul pulled to a stop, and she confronted the guards. The men stumbled to a halt, jaws dropping. Behind, Nananav broke the silence.
What are you idiots doing? What?
She trailed off, then pulled up short as Shallan turned to look at her, wearing the woman's face. Same hair, same features, same clothing. Mimicked right down to the attitude, with nose in the air. Shallan Nananav raised her hands to the side, and spren burst from the ground around the wagon, pools of blood shimmering the wrong color and boiling far too violently, pieces of glass that rained down, anticipation spren, like thin tentacles. Shallan Nananav let her image distort, features sliding off her face, dripping down like paint running down a wall. Ordinary Nananav screamed and fled back toward the building. One of the guards loosed his crossbow, and the bolt took Shallan Nananav right in the head. Bother. Her vision went dark for a moment, and she had a flash of panic, remembering her stabbing in the palace. But why should she care if actual pain spren joined the illusory ones around her? She righted herself and looked back toward the soldiers, her face melting, the crossbow bolt sticking from her temple. The guards ran.
Vatha,
she said,
push open the gate.
Her mouth didn't work right. How odd. Vatha didn't move, so she glared at him.
Gah!
He shouted, scrambling back and stumbling across one of the rugs in the bed of the wagon. He fell down beside Red, who was surrounded by fear spren, like globs of goo. Even Ishna looked as if she'd seen a void bringer. Shallan let the illusions go, all of them, right down to Vale, just normal everyday Vale.
Is all right,
Vale said.
Just illusions. Go. Open the gates.
Vatha heaved himself out of the wagon and ran for the gates.
Vale? Red said. That crossbow bolt? The blood is staining your outfit.
I was going to throw it away regardless, she said,
settling back down, growing more comfortable as Pattern rejoined the wagon and scuttled across the seat to her.
I've got a new outfit almost ready.
At this rate, she'd have to buy them in bulk. They maneuvered the wagon out the gates, then picked up Vatha. No guards gave pursuit, and Vale's mind drifted as they pulled away.
That crossbow bolt was getting annoying.
She couldn't feel her safe hand. Bother. She poked at the bolt. It seemed that her stormlight had healed her head around the wound. She gritted her teeth and tried to pull it out, but the thing was jammed in there. Her vision blurred again.
I'm going to need some help, boys, she said,
pointing at it and drawing in more stormlight. She blacked out entirely when Vatha pulled it free. She came to a short time later, slumped in the front seat of the wagon. When she brushed the side of her head with her fingers, she found no hole.
You worry me sometimes, Vatha said,
steering the Chul with a reed.
I do what needs to be done,
Vale said, relaxing back and setting her feet up on the front of the wagon. Was it only her imagination? Or did the people lining the streets today look hungrier than they had previous days? Hunger spren buzzed about the heads of the people, like black specks, or little flies of the type you could find sometimes on rotting plants. Children cried in the laps of exhausted mothers. Vale turned away, ashamed, thinking of the food she had hidden in the wagon. How much good could she do with all of that? How many tears could she dry? How many of the hungry cries of children could she silence?
Steady.
Infiltrating the cult of moments was a greater good than feeding a few mouths now. She needed this food to buy her way in, to investigate the heart of the revel, as Wit had called it. Vale didn't know much of the unmade. She'd never paid attention to the Ardents on important matters, let alone when they spoke of old folk tales and stories of Voidbringers. Shallan knew little more, and wanted to find a book about the subject, of course. Last night, Vale had returned to the inn where Shallan had met with the King's Wit, and while he hadn't been there, he'd left a message for her. "I'm still trying to get you a contact among the cult's hires. Everyone I talk to merely says do something to get their attention. I would, but I'm certain that violating the city's indecency laws would be unwise, even considering the lack of a proper watch." Do something to get their attention. They seemed to have their fingers in everything in this city. Kind of like the Ghost Bloods, watching secretly. Maybe she didn't need to wait for Wit. And maybe she could solve two problems at once. "Take us to the Ringington Market," she said to Vatha, naming the market closest to the tailor's shop.
"Aren't we going to unload the food before we return the wagon to that merchant?"
"Of course we are," she said. He eyed her, but when she didn't explain further, he turned the wagon as she directed. Vale took her hat and coat from the back of the wagon and pulled them on, then covered the bloodstains on her shirt with a light weaving. She had Vatha pull up to a specific building in the market. When they stopped, refugees peeked into the wagon bed, but saw only rugs, and they scattered when Vatha glared at them. "Guard the wagon," Vale said, digging out a small sack of food. She hopped down and went sauntering toward the building. The roof had been ruined by the Everstorm, making it a perfect place for squatters. She found Grund inside the main room as usual. She'd returned several times during her time in the city, getting information from Grund, who was the grimy little urchin she'd bribed with food on her first day in the market. He seemed to always be hanging around here, and Vale was well aware of the value of having a local urchin to ply for information. Today he was alone in the room. The other beggars were out hunting food. Grund drew on a little board with charcoal, using his one good hand, the deformed one hidden in his pocket. He perked up as soon as he saw her. He'd stopped running away. It seemed that city urchins got concerned when someone was actively looking for them. That changed when they knew you had food. He tried to look uninterested until Vale dropped the sack in front of him. A sausage peeked out. Then his dark eyes practically bulged out of his face.
"An entire sack?"
Grund asked. "It was a good day," Vale said, squatting down. "Any news for me on those books?"
"Nope,"
he said, poking the sausage, as if to see whether she'd suddenly snatch it back.
"I ain't heard nothing."
"Let me know if you do. In the meantime, do you know of anyone who could use a little extra food? People who are particularly nice or deserving, but who get overlooked by the grain rationing?" He eyed her, trying to determine her angle.
"I've got extra to give away," Vale explained.
"You're going to give them food?" He said it as if it was as rational as making kremlings fall from the sky.
"Surely I'm not the first. The palace used to give food to the poor, didn't it? That's a thing that kings do, not regular people."
He looked her up and down.
"But you aren't regular people."
"I'm not."
"Well, Muri the seamstress has always been nice to me.
She's got lots of kids, having trouble feeding them. She has a hovel over by the old bakery that burned down on that first ever night. And the refugee kids that live in the park over on Moonlight Way. They're just little, you know? Nobody to watch for them. And Jom, the cobbler, he broke his arm. You want to write this down or something? I'll remember. He shrugged and gave her an extensive list. She thanked him, then reminded him to keep looking for the book she'd asked for. Ishna had visited some booksellers on Shallan's orders, and one had mentioned a title called Mythica, a newer volume that spoke of the unmade. The bookseller had owned a copy, but his shop had been robbed during the riots. Hopefully someone in the underground knew where his goods had gone. Vale had a spring to her step as she walked back to the wagon. The cult wanted her to get their attention? Well, she'd get their attention. She doubted Grun's list was unbiased, but stopping right in the middle of the market and heaving out sacks seemed likely to incite a riot. This was as good a method to give away the food as any. Muri the seamstress proved to indeed be a woman with many children and little means of feeding them. The children in the park were right where Grund had indicated. Vale left a heap of food for them, then walked away as they scrambled up to it in amazement. By the fourth stop, Vatha had figured it out.
You're going to give it all away, aren't you?
Not all, Vale said, lounging in her seat as they rolled toward the next destination.
What about paying the cult of moments?
We can always steal more. First, my contact says we have to get their attention. I figure a crazy woman in white riding through the market throwing out sacks of food is bound to do that.
You've got the crazy part right, at least.
Vale slipped her hand back into a rolled-up carpet and pulled out a sausage for him. Eat something. It'll make you feel better. He grumbled, but took it and bit at the end. By the evening, the cart was empty. Vale wasn't certain if she could get the cult's attention this way, but storms did it feel good to be doing something. Shallan could go off and study books, talk plots, and scheme. Vale would worry about the people who were actually starving. She didn't give it all away, though. She let Vatha keep his sausage.
73. Telling Witch Stories. I am worried about the tower's protections failing. If we are not safe from the unmade here, then where? From Drawer 311, Garnet.
Stuff it, Beard, Ved said. You did not meet the Blackthorn.
I did,
the other soldier said. He complimented me on my uniform and gave me his own knife for valor.
Liar.
Be careful, Beard said. Cal might stab you if you keep interrupting a good story.
Me, Kaladin said, walking with the others of the squad on patrol. Don't bring me into this, Beard.
Look at him, Beard said. He's got hungry eyes, Ved. He wants to hear the end of the story.
Kaladin smiled with the others. He had joined the Wall Guard officially upon Elokar's orders, and had promptly been added to Lieutenant Noro's squad. It felt almost cheap to be part of the group so quickly after the effort it had been to forge Bridge 4. Still, Kaladin liked these men, and enjoyed their banter as they ran their patrol beat along the inside base of the wall. 6 men was a lot for a simple patrol, but Azure wanted them to stay in groups. Along with Beard, Ved, and Noro, the squad included a heavyset man named Alloward, and a friendly man named Vasilev. Alethi, but with obvious Thalen heritage. The two kept trying to get Kaladin to play cards with them. It was an uncomfortable reminder of Saw and the Parshmen.
Well, you won't believe what happened next, Beard continued. The Blackthorn told me... Oh, storm it, you're not listening, are you?
Nope, Ved said. Too busy looking at that.
He nodded back at something they'd passed. Beard snickered.
Ha!
Will you look at that roosting chicken? Who does he think he's impressing?
Storm and waste of skin, Bed agreed. Cal grinned, glanced over his shoulder, looking for whoever Beard and Bed had spotted. Must be someone silly to provoke such a strong... It was Adolin. The prince lounged on the corner wearing a false face and a yellow suit after the new fashionable style. He was guarded by Drahi, who stood several inches taller, happily munching on some chowder.
Somewhere, Beard said solemnly, a kingdom is without its banners because that fellow bought them all up and made coats out of them.
Where do they think up these things? Vasilev asked. I mean, storms. Do they just say, you know what I need for the apocalypse? You know what would be really handy? A new coat. Extra sequins.
They passed Adolin, who nodded toward Kaladin, then looked away. That meant all was well, and Kaladin could continue with the guards. A shake of the head would have been the sign to extricate himself and return to the tailor's shop. Beard continued to snicker.
When in the service of the merchant lords of Steen, he noted, I once had to swim across an entire vat of dye in order to save the prince's daughter. When I was done, I still wasn't as colorful as that preening kremling.
Alloward grunted. Storming highborns. Useless for anything but giving bad orders and eating twice as much food as an honest man.
But, Kaladin said, how can you say that? I mean, he's light-eyed, like us. He winced. Did that sound fake?
It sure is nice being light-eyed, as I, of course, have light eyes. Like you, my eyes are lighter than the dark eyes of dark eyes.
He had to summon Syl several times a day to keep his eye color from changing.
Like us? Beard said. Cal, what crevasse have you been living in? Are the Middlers actually useful where you come from?
Some, Kaladin said. Beard and Ved, well, the whole squad except Noro, were tenors. Men of the Tenth Dawn, lowest ranking in the light-eyed stratification system.
Kaladin hadn't ever paid much attention. To him, light-eyes had always just been light-eyes.
These men saw the world very differently.
Middlers were anyone better than Eighth Dawn, but who weren't quite High Lords. They might as well have been another species for how the squadsmen thought of them, particularly those of the Fifth and Sixth Dawn, who didn't serve in the military. How was it that these men somehow naturally ended up surrounding themselves with others of their own rank? They married tenors, drank with tenors, joked with tenors. They had their own jargon and traditions. There was an entire world represented here that Kaladin had never seen, despite it residing right next door to him.
Some Middlers are useful, Kaladin said. Some of them are good at dueling. Maybe we could go back and recruit that guy. He was wearing a sword.
The others looked at him like he was mad.
Cal McKip, Beard said.
Kip was a slang word that Kaladin hadn't quite figured out yet.
You're a good fellow. I like how you see the best in folks. You haven't even learned to ignore me yet, which most folks decide to do after our first meal together. But you've got to learn to see the world for how it is. You can't go around trusting Middlers, unless they're good officers like the High Marshal. Men like that one back there, they'll strut about telling you everything you should do, but put them on the wall during an attack, and they'll wet themselves yellower than that suit.
They have parties, Bet agreed. Best thing for them, really. Keeps them out of our business.
What a strange mix of emotions. On one hand, he wanted to tell them about Amaram and rant about the injustices done, repeatedly, to those he loved. At the same time, they were mocking Adolin Colin, who had a shot at the title of best swordsman in all of Alethkar. Yes, his suit was a little bright, but if they would merely spend 5 minutes talking to him, they'd see he wasn't so bad.
Kaladin trudged along. It felt wrong to be on patrol without a spear, and he instinctively sought out Syl, who rode the winds above. He'd been given a side sword to carry at his right, a truncheon to carry at his left, and a small round shield. The first thing the wall guard had taught him was how to draw the sword by reaching down with his right hand, not lowering his shield, and pulling it free of the sheath. They wouldn't use sword or truncheon when the Voidbringers finally assaulted. There were proper pikes up above for that. Down here was a different matter. The large road, it rounded the city alongside the wall, was clear and clean, maintained by the guard. But most of the streets that branched off it were crowded with people. Nobody but the poorest and most wretched wanted to be this close to the walls.
"How is it," Ved said, "those refugees can't get it through their heads, that we're the only thing separating them from the army outside?"
Indeed, many of those they passed on side streets watched the patrol with outright hostility. At least nobody had thrown anything at them today.
"They see that we're fed," Noro replied. "They smell food from our barracks. They're not thinking with their heads, but with their stomachs."
"Half of those belong to the cult, anyway," Beard noted. "One of these days I'll have to infiltrate that. Might have to marry their high priestess. But let me tell you, I'm terrible in a harem. Last time, the other men grew jealous of me taking all the priestess's attention."
"She laughed so hard at your offering she got distracted, eh?" Ved asked.
"Actually, there's a story about—"
"Calm it, Beard," the lieutenant said. "Let's get ready for the delivery." He shifted his shield to his other hand, then took out his truncheon.
"Get intimidating, everybody. Truncheons only."
The group pulled out their wooden cudgels. It felt wrong to have to defend themselves from their own people. Brought back memories of being in Amaram's army bivouacking near towns. Everyone had always talked about the glories of the army and the fight on the shattered plains. And yet, once towns got done gawking, they transitioned to hostility with remarkable speed. An army was the sort of thing everyone wanted to have, so long as it was off doing important things elsewhere. Noro's squad met up with another from their platoon, with two squads on the wall for duty, two squads off, and two down here patrolling. They were around 40 strong. Together, the 12 men formed up to guard a slow, chull-pulled wagon that left one of their larger barrack warehouses. It carried a mound of closed sacks. Refugees crowded around, and Kaladin brandished his truncheon. He had to use his shield to shove a man who got too close. Fortunately, this caused others to back away instead of rushing the wagon. They rolled inward only one street before stopping at a city square. Syl flitted down and rested on his shoulder.
They look like they hate you.
"Not me," Kaladin whispered. "The uniform."
"What? What will you do if they actually attack?"
He didn't know. He hadn't come to this city to fight the populace, but if he refused to defend the squad...
"Storming Velalant is late," Ved grumbled.
"A little more time," Noro said. "We'll be fine. The good people know this food goes to them eventually." "Yes, after they wait hours in line at Velalant's distribution stations." Farther into the city, obscured by the gathering crowds, a group of people approached in stark violet with masks obscuring their faces. Kaladin watched uncomfortably as they started whipping their own forearms, drawing painspren, which climbed from the ground around them, like hands missing the skin. Except these were too large, and the wrong color, and didn't seem human.
"I prayed to the spren of the night, and they came to me,"
a man at their forefront shouted, raising hands high.
"They rid me of my pain."
"Oh, no,"
Syl whispered.
"Embrace them. The spren of changes. The spren of a new storm. A new land. A new people."
Kaladin took Noro by the arm.
"Sir, we need to retreat. Get this grain back to the warehouse."
"We have orders to—"
Noro trailed off as he glanced to the increasingly hostile crowd. Fortunately, a group of some 50 men in blue and red rounded a corner and began shoving aside refugees with rough hands and barked shouts. Noro's sigh was almost comically loud. The angry crowd broke away as Velalant's troops surrounded the grain shipment.
"Why do we do this in the daytime?" Kaladin asked one of their officers. "And why don't you simply come to our warehouse and escort it from there? Why the display?"
A soldier moved him, politely but firmly, back from the wagon. The troops surrounded it and marched it away, the crowd flowing after them. When they got back to the wall, Kaladin felt like a man seeing land after swimming all the way to Thelena. He pressed his palm against the stone, feeling its cool, rough grain, drawing a sense of safety from it, much as he would draw out stormlight. It would have been easy to fight that crowd. They were basically unarmed. But while training prepared you for the mechanics of the fight, the emotions were another thing entirely. Syl huddled on his shoulder, staring back along the street.
"This is all the Queen's fault," Beard muttered softly. "If she hadn't killed that Ardent..."
"Stop with that," Noro said sharply. He took a deep breath. "My squad, we're on the wall next. You have half an hour to grab a drink or a nap, then assemble at our station above."
"And storms be praised for that," Beard said, heading straight for the stairwell, obviously planning to get to the station above, then relax. "I'll happily take some time staring down an enemy army, thank you very much."
Kaladin joined Beard in climbing. He still didn't know where the man had gotten his nickname. Noro was the only one in the squad who wore a beard, though his wasn't exactly inspiring. Rock would have laughed it to shame and euthanized it with a razor and some soap.
"Why do we pay off the High Lord's beard?" Kaladin asked as they climbed. "Velalant and his type are pretty useless from what I've seen."
"Yeah. We lost the real High Lords and the riots are to the palace. But the High Marshal knows what to do. I suspect that if we didn't share with people like Velalant, we'd have to fight them off from seizing the grain. At least this way people are eventually getting fed, and we can watch the wall."
They talked like that a lot. Holding the city wall was their job, and if they looked too far afield, tried too hard to police the city or bring down the cult, they'd lose their focus. The city had to stand. Even if it burned inside, it had to stand. To an extent, Kaladin agreed. The army couldn't do everything. It still hurt.
"When are you going to tell me how we make all that food?" Kaladin whispered.
Beard looked around in the stairwell. He leaned in. "I don't know, Cal. But the first thing that Azure did when he took command... had us attack the low monastery by the eastern gates away from the palace. I know men from other companies who were on that assault. The place had been overrun by rioters."
"They had a soulcaster, didn't they?"
Beard nodded.
"Only one in the city that wasn't at the palace when it, you know."
"But how do we use it without drawing the screamers?" Kaladin asked.
"Well," Beard said, and his tone shifted. "I can't tell you all the secrets, but..."
He launched into a story about the time Beard himself had learned to use a soulcaster from the King of Herdaz. Maybe he wasn't the best source of information.
"The High Marshal," Kaladin interrupted. "Have you noticed the odd thing about her shard blade? No gemstone on the pommel or crossguard."
Beard eyed him, lit by the stairwell's window slits. Calling the High Marshal a she always provoked a response.
"Maybe that's why the High Marshal never dismisses it," Beard said. "Maybe it's broken somehow?"
"Maybe," Kaladin said.
Aside from his fellow Radiance Blades, he'd seen one shard blade before that didn't have a gemstone on it. The blade of the assassin in white. An honor blade, which granted radiant powers to whoever held it. If Azure held a weapon that let her have the power of soul casting, perhaps that explained why the screamers hadn't found out yet. They finally emerged onto the top of the wall, stepping into sunlight. The two of them stopped there, looking inward over the flowing city, with the breaching wind blades and rolling hills. The palace, ever in gloom, dominated the far side. The wall guard barely patrolled the section of wall that passed behind it. "Did you know anyone in the palace guard ranks?" Kaladin asked. "Are any of the men in there still in contact with families out here or anything?" Beard shook his head.
"I got close a little while back. I heard voices, Cal, whispering to me to join them. The High Marshal says we have to close our ears to those. They can't take us unless we listen."
He rested his hand on Kaladin's shoulder.
"Your questions are honest, Cal, but you worry too much. We need to focus on the wall. Best not to talk too much about the Queen or the palace. Like we don't talk about Azure being a woman."
"Her secret," Beard winced, "I mean, the High Marshal's secret, is ours to guard and protect."
"We do a storming poor job of that, then. Hopefully we're better at defending the wall."
Beard shrugged, hand still on Kaladin's shoulder. For the first time, Kaladin noticed something. "No glyph ward." Beard glanced at his arm, where he wore the traditional white armband that you'd tie a glyph ward around. His was blank.
"Yeah," he said, shoving his hand in his coat pocket.
"Why not?" Kaladin said. Beard shrugged.
"Let's just say, I know a lot about telling which stories have been made up. Nobody's watching over us, Cal."
He trudged off toward their muster station, one of the tower structures that lined the wall. Syl stood up on Kaladin's shoulder, then walked up, as if on invisible steps, through the air to stand even with his eyes. She looked after Beard, her girlish dress rippling in wind that Kaladin couldn't feel.
"Dalinar thinks God isn't dead," she said, "just that the Almighty, Honor, was never actually God."
"You're part of Honor. Doesn't that offend you?"
"Every child eventually realizes that her father isn't actually God."
She looked at him.
"Do you think anybody is watching? Do you really think there isn't anything out there?"
Strange question to answer, to a little bit of a divinity. Kaladin lingered in the doorway to the guard tower. Inside, the men of his squad, Platoon 7, Squad 2, which didn't have the same ring to it as Bridge 4, laughed and banged about as they gathered equipment.
"I used to take the terrible things that had happened to me," he said, "as proof that there was no God. Then, in some of my darkest moments, I took my life as proof there must be something up there, for only intentional cruelty could offer an explanation."
He took a deep breath, then looked toward the clouds. He'd been delivered up to the sky, and had found magnificence there. He'd been given the power to protect and defend.
"Now," he said, "now I don't know. With all due respect, I think Dalinar's beliefs sound too convenient. Now that one deity has proven faulty, he insists the Almighty must never have been God? That there must be something else? I don't like it. So, maybe this simply isn't a question we can ever answer."
He stepped into the fortification. It had broad doorways on either side leading in from the wall, while slits along the outward side provided archer positions, as did the roof. To his right stood racks of weapons and shields and a table for mess. Above that, a large window looked out at the city beyond, where those inside could get specific orders via signal flags from below. He was sliding his shield onto a rack when the drums sounded, calling the alarm. Syl zipped up behind him like a string suddenly pulled taut.
"Assault on the wall!"
Kaladin shouted, reading the drum beats.
"Equip up!"
He scrambled across the room and seized a pike from the line on the wall. He tossed it to the first man who came, then continued distributing as the men scrambled to obey the signals. Lieutenant Noro and Beard handed out shields, rectangular full shields in contrast to the small round patrolling shields they'd carried below.
"Form up!"
Kaladin shouted, right before Noro did it.
"Storms, I'm not their commander."
Feeling like an idiot, Kaladin took his own pike and balanced the long pole, carrying it out beside Beard, who carried only a shield. On the wall, the four squads formed a bristling formation of pikes and overlapping shields. Some of the men in the center, like Kaladin and Noro, held only a pike, gripping it two-handed. Sweat trickled down Kaladin's temples. He'd been trained briefly in pike blocks during his time in Amaram's army. They were used as a counter to heavy cavalry, which was a newer development in Alethi warfare. He couldn't imagine that they'd be terribly effective atop a wall. They were great for thrusting outward toward an enemy block of troops, but it was difficult for him to keep the pike pointed upward. It didn't balance well that way. But how else were they to fight the fused? The other platoon that shared a station with them formed up on the tower's top, holding bows. Hopefully, the arrow cover mixed with the defensive pike formation would be effective. Kaladin finally saw the fused streaking through the air, approaching another section of the wall. Men in his platoon waited, nervous, adjusting glyph wards or repositioning shields. The fused clashed distantly with others of the wall guard. Kaladin could barely make out yells. The drumbeats from the drummers' stations were a holding beat, telling everyone to remain in their own section. Syl came zipping back, moving agitatedly, sweeping one way then the other. Several men in the formation leaned out as if wanting to break away and go charging to where their fellows were fighting. Steady, Kaladin thought, but cut himself off from saying it. He wasn't in command here. Captain Didenor, the platoon leader, hadn't arrived yet, which meant Noro was the ranking officer, with seniority over the other squad lieutenants. Kaladin gritted his teeth, straining, forcibly keeping himself from giving any kind of order until, blessedly, Noro spoke up.
"Now, don't you break away, Hid," the lieutenant called. "Keep your shields together, men. If we rush off now, we'll be easy pickings."
The men reluctantly pulled back into formation. Eventually, the fused streaked away. Their strikes never lasted long. They would hit hard, testing reaction times at various places along the wall, and they often broke into and searched the towers nearby. They were preparing for a true assault, and, Kaladin figured, also trying to find out how the wall guard was feeding itself. The drums signaled for the squads to stand down, and the men of Kaladin's platoon lethargically trudged back to their tower. A sense of frustration accompanied them. Pent-up aggression. All of that anxiety, the rush of the battle, only to stand around and sweat while other men died. Kaladin helped rack up the weapons, then got himself a bowl of stew and joined Lieutenant Noro, who was waiting on the wall right outside the tower. A messenger used signal flags to indicate to others down in the city that Noro's platoon hadn't engaged.
"You have my apologies, sir," Kaladin said softly. "I'll see it doesn't happen again."
It?
"I preempted you earlier," Kaladin said. "Gave orders when it was your place."
"Oh, well, you're quite quick off the cuff, Cal. Eager for combat, I'd say."
"Perhaps, sir."
"You want to prove yourself to the team," Noro said, rubbing his wispy beard. "Well, I like a man with enthusiasm. Keep your head, and I suspect you'll end up as a squad leader before too long."
He said it like a proud parent.
"Permission, sir, to be excused from duty? There might be wounded that need my attention farther along the wall."
"Wounded? Cal, I know you said you had some field medicine training, but the army's surgeons will be there already."
"Right. They'd have actual surgeons." Noro clapped him on the shoulder.
"Go in and eat your stew. There will be enough action later. Don't run too fast toward danger, all right?"
I'll try to remember that, sir."
Still, there was nothing to do but walk back into the tower, Syl alighting on his shoulder, and sit down to eat his stew.
74. Swiftspren. Today I leaped from the tower for the last time. I felt the wind dance around me as I fell all the way along the eastern side, past the tower and to the foothills below. I'm going to miss that. From Drawer 10-1, Sapphire. Vale leaned her head to look in through the window of the old broken shop in the market. Grund the urchin sat in his usual place, carefully stripping down an old pair of shoes for the hog's hide. As he heard Vale, he dropped his tool and reached for a knife with his good hand. He saw that it was her, then caught the package of food she tossed to him. It was smaller this time, but actually had some fruit. Very rare in the city these days. The urchin pulled the bag of food close, closing his dark green eyes, looking reserved. What an odd expression. He's still suspicious of me, she thought. He's wondering what I'll someday demand of him for all this. Where are Ma and Selland? Vale asked. She had prepared packages for the two women who stayed here with Grund.
Moved out to the old tinker's place, Grund said.
He thumbed upward, toward the sagging ceiling.
Thought this place was getting too dangerous. You sure you don't want to do the same? Nah, he said. I can finally move without kicking someone.
She left him and shoved her hands in her pockets, wearing her new coat and hat against the cool air. She'd hoped that Kulinar would prove to be warmer after so long on the Shattered Plains or Urethiru. But it was cold here, too, suffering a season of winter weather. Perhaps the arrival of the Everstorm was to be blamed. She checked in on Muri next, the former seamstress with three daughters. She was of second none, high ranking for a Dark Eyes, and had run a successful business in a town near Revelar. Now she trolled the water ditches following storms for the corpses of rats and kremlings. Muri always had some gossip that was amusing but generally pointless. Vale left about an hour later and made her way out of the market, dropping her last package in the lap of a random beggar. The old beggar sniffed the package, then whooped with excitement.
"The Swift Spren," he said,
nudging one of the other beggars.
"Look, the Swift Spren,"
he cackled, digging into the package, and his friend roused from his sleep and snatched some flatbread. "Swift Spren?" Vale asked.
"That's you," he said. "Yep, yep, I heard of you. Robbing rich folk all through the city, you do. And nobody can stop you, 'cause you're a spren. Can walk through walls, you can. White hat, white coat. Don't always appear the same, do ya?"
The beggar started stuffing his face. Vale smiled. Her reputation was spreading. She'd enhanced it by sending Ishna and Vatha out, wearing illusions to look like Vale, giving away food. Surely the cult couldn't ignore her much longer. Pattern hummed as she stretched. Exhaustion spren, all of the corrupted variety, spinning about her in the air, little red whirlwinds. The merchant she'd stolen from earlier had chased her away himself, and had been nimble for his age.
"Why?" Pattern asked.
"Why what?" Vale asked. "Why is the sky blue, the sun bright? Why do storms blow or rains fall?"
"Why are you so happy about feeding so few?"
"Feeding these few is something we can do."
"So is jumping from a building," he said. Frank, as if he didn't understand the sarcasm he used. "But we do not do this." "You lie, Shallan."
"Vale."
"Your lies wrap other lies."
He sounded drowsy. Could Spren get drowsy?
"Remember your ideal, the truth you spoke."
She shoved her hands in her pockets. Evening was coming, the sun slipping toward the western horizon, as if it were running from the origin and the storms. It was the individual touch, the light in the eyes of people she gave to, that really excited her. Feeding them felt so much more real than the rest of the plan to infiltrate the cult and investigate the Oath Gate. "It's too small," she thought. That was what Yasna would say. "I'm thinking too small." Along the street, she passed people who whimpered and suffered. Far too many hunger spren in the air, and fear spren at nearly every corner. She had to do something to help. like throwing a thimbleful of water onto a bonfire. She stood at an intersection, head bowed, as the shadows grew long, reaching toward night. Chanting broke her out of her trance. How long had she been standing there? Flickering light, orange and primal, painted a street to her left. No sphere glowed that color. She walked toward it, pulling off her hat and sucking in stormlight. She released it in a puff, then stepped through, trailing tendrils that wrapped around her and transformed her shape. People had gathered, as they usually did, when the cult of moments paraded. Swift Spren broke through them, wearing the costume of a Spren from her notes. Notes she'd lost to the sea. A Spren shaped like a glowing arrowhead that wove through the sky around sky eels. Golden tassels streamed from her back, long, with arrowhead shapes at the ends. Her entire front was wrapped in cloth that trailed behind, her arms, legs, and face covered. Swift Spren flowed among the cultists and drew stares even from them. I have to do more, she thought. I have to think grander schemes. Could Shallan's lies help her be something more than a broken girl from rural Yakaved? A girl who was deep down terrified that she had no idea what she was doing? The cultists chanted softly, repeating the words of the leaders at the front. Our time has passed. Our time has passed. The Spren have come. The Spren have come. Give them our sins. Give them our sins. Yes. She could feel it. The freedom these people felt. It was the peace of surrender. They coursed down the street, proffering their torches and lanterns toward the sky, wearing the garb of Spren. Why worry? Embrace the release. Embrace the transition. Embrace the coming of storm and Spren. Embrace the end. Swift Spren breathed in their chants and saturated herself with their ideas. She became them, and she could hear it, whispering in the back of her mind. Surrender. Give me your passion, your pain, your love. Give up your guilt. Embrace the end. Shallan, I'm not your enemy. That last one stood out like a scar on a beautiful man's face. Jarring. She came to herself. Storms.